WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the mother of an African-American son, Marita Golden says she's always afraid. She's afraid that, although she's tried to pave a straight and narrow path for him to tread, that he may make a fatal detour and become a victim of racism, other black teenagers, or of his own bad judgment, and end up dead or in jail. Golden is the author of the new memoir, Saving Our Sons, Raising Black Children in a Turbulent World. She's the author of a previous memoir called Migrations of the Heart, as well as three novels. She separated from her son's father when her son was a child. For many years, she raised him as a single mother. She met and married her second husband when her son Michael was in his early teens. He's now 17. She's raised her son in Boston, Washington, D.C., and suburban Washington. She told me when she gets together with other mothers of African-American sons, they often share their fears about their son's physical safety. Golden says, unfortunately, in the African-American community, there's a disproportionately high rate of crime.
We in the African-American community know that it is not the entire community that is responsible for the crime, that it is a small percentage of our community, despite how that may be presented to the larger society. But I think physical safety is real. It's a real important issue, and that all the mothers that I know are deeply concerned about, as one of the women I talked to in the book said, just literally keeping our sons alive.
There was a turning point in your son's development when he became a teenager and he started walking the gangster walk. And you could tell that when he passed women, that women would get nervous around him, they'd clutch their purses. Would you describe the change that he went through then and what your reaction to it was?
Well, I think that took place when my son was probably about 14. And this, of course, is an age when he's in adolescence and he's beginning to grapple with the whole issue of maleness and manhood and his role in the community, his role in society. And we have a long tradition in the African-American community of a particular kind of walk. When I was a young person, we called it pimping. Nowadays, it's called the cool pose or the gangster walk. And it's rooted in the different way in which African-Americans, and specifically African-American males, use their bodies, whether they're athletes, whether they're performers. There is simply a different way that African-Americans walk down the street, enter a room, use their physical aspects. But the gangster walk is a particular walk that's designed, as I say in the book, to let the world know that you are strong, that you're capable, that you're tough, that you're not a vulnerable person, that you're not someone who it would be advisable to challenge. So my son, who's really a pretty mild-mannered kid, who has a pretty innocent face, felt that he had to adopt that pose, and he had to adopt it as a kind of camouflage of, I think, his real personality, and as a way of navigating himself and navigating his way through streets that could sometimes be quite challenging.
Now, what are the dangers that you felt he faced once he took on that look and took on that walk? What kind of signals did it mean he was sending out?
Well, if the pose is not performed with the right amount of subtlety and expertise, it can signal exactly the opposite of what it's meant to signal. It can signal not that you're cool, not that you're, you know, you're really tough, but that you are very self-conscious and that you are so insecure and so self-conscious that you're actually overdoing the pose. And the gangster pose is just one of those subtle mechanisms that young African-American men have to learn to master when they're wending their way through the black community. And then when you get in the white community, you have to drop the gangster pose and take on some other camouflages.
You describe in the book a talk that your husband had with your son about how to present himself in public in the presence of other black males that he didn't know. And your husband told him, don't stare, You're tall, but you've got an innocent face that sends a mixed message to people who are looking for trouble. And people can tell you're a good kid just by looking at you, and they'll mess with you just because of that. And this led you to think, well, you know, in the South, African-American parents used to warn their children never to look a white person straight in the eyes. And now your son has to develop a body language that's going to protect him in the middle of other black people. And that was all very disturbing to you.
Well, yeah, it is very disturbing. And it's a commentary on the increasing violence in the larger society and in the African-American community. And it's a commentary, I think, as well on how far we have moved away from a sense of community in the larger society and in the African-American community, that you really have to walk around with a kind of acceptable level of paranoia, so that arming my son with the kinds of antennae, so to speak, to navigate his way through his own community is another issue which wasn't quite as intense, I know, when I was growing up.
You're right, there's a war on black men, but there's an internal war that black men wage against each other as well. How do you fight on two fronts?
I've raised him pretty much the way I was raised. I talk a lot in my home, my husband and I, about personal choices, about the fact that even though when we turn on the television, sure, my son sees a lot of young black males, a lot of black men in handcuffs, but we talk to him about the fact that he doesn't have to be one of those black men, that he can make the kinds of choices in his life that will put him on another path. So those are the kinds of issues that I think you can really talk with your kid about. And I think as dangerous and as difficult as it is, that it is possible to raise a healthy young black male who can beat the odds.
As a middle-class parent, you had the economic options of making choices, the choice of what kind of school to send your son to, what kind of neighborhood to live in. Let's start with school. At one point, you decided you were going to take him out of the public schools and put him into a private boarding school. Was there a turning point for you in making that decision?
Well, yeah, there were two turning points. One, well, the main turning point was when he was about to enter high school. We made the decision when he was a ninth grader in junior high. And as we looked towards junior high school, with my son having only 3 years left in public school, 3 years before he went to college, we knew that we had to put him in an environment that would be optimum in a positive sense. My son was one of these very bright kids who'd actually been raised in what might be called a culturally over-rich home. He traveled all over the world. His mother was a writer, a college professor. He'd been exposed to a myriad of experience, all of them very positive. But he had some problems with focus in school. He was a class clown, and his grades were fairly average. So we felt that because of that, and also because of the increasing incidence of violence, and we knew that in high school it would probably increase, that we wanted to get him into an environment that would be as radically different and as radically positive as we could find. And that turned out to be, to our surprise, a boarding school. And I say to my surprise because the idea of sending my son to a boarding school simply came out of a conversation I had with a friend who said that her sister-in-law had a son who went to a boarding school and it worked out very well. But the combination of really knowing that as the mother of a black son, my son needed as many advantages as I could give him, knowing that if he made any mistakes, he would pay triple time, double time for them, I wanted to do all I could to put him in the best type of environment I could find.
Did he fight you about going to a boarding school?
Oh, sure. I mean, he didn't want to go. He thought, you know, we were the meanest parents on earth. He promised that if we didn't send him away, he'd start studying and he'd start bringing, you know, the kind of grades we felt he could. But interestingly enough, when we went to several boarding schools and had interviews and really saw what the boarding school environment was like, his resistance kind of melted. And he felt that all the kids at the boarding schools were nerds. He felt that there would be no way he could fit in. And when he saw that the kids who were just like him, black kids, kids who were fairly normal, went to these schools, I think some of his anxieties faded.
Marita Golden is my guest. She's the author of a new memoir called Saving Our Sons, Raising Black Children in a Turbulent World. For many years, you raised your son as a single mother, and then you married your husband when your son was how old?
13.
Did you go through a crisis, a personal crisis of what, you know, what am I depriving my son of as a single mother? Will he be terribly shortchanged because there isn't a man in the house? How much did you worry about that?
Oh, yeah, sure. I think that, I mean, I know that I went through that a lot, and I know that other women who are single mothers go through that. At the time that I was a single parent, there was so much negative publicity about the ability or the supposed inability of women to raise children alone successfully that I suffered a tremendous amount of anxiety about how well I was performing this task. And as an African-American woman in my community, there wasn't a lot of support for what I was doing, despite the fact that two-thirds of the children in the African-American community are raised by women who are heading households, so that you find yourself buffeted on all sides, the larger society, through newspaper, magazine articles, everything in the media questions and challenges whether you can do this job. And in your own community where you think you would find a lot of support, you find very often the same challenges.
What were the specific challenges coming from the African-American community?
Well, black women get all the blame for African-American males who end up in jail. If these women were just better mothers, if these women would stop indulging these boys, the crime problem would be solved overnight. And what you have there is the typical scapegoating of the female. You don't have a real discussion of the totality of the lives that these women live. Often these women are women who are struggling against tremendous economic odds. They may not have family support. They may not have any relationship with the father of these boys. And very often in our community, a lot of the institutions that we look to for support, like the church, like sororities and fraternities, turn a blind eye to the lives of these women, often because I feel they are lower class women. They are women who are not educated. They're women who are poor. And there are certain class issues that we have in our community that we have to address.
When you looked at the situation as honestly as you could, what were your greatest fears about what you as a single mother couldn't provide?
Well, I knew that I could. The only thing that I knew for certain was that I could not provide a male role model for my son. I never felt for a moment that I could teach my son what it meant to be a man, but I did know that I could teach him what it meant to be a good citizen, that I could teach him what it meant to be a good human being. But I always knew that he was going to need male role models. And so when my son moved into adolescence before I met my husband, I reestablished my relationship with his father. I got him a big brother. I formed a single parents group that was both male and female. And I literally surrounded my son with as many positive men as I could find.
When you got married to your husband, Joe, did the dynamic change in the house? Did you find that there were things that your husband, as a man, could tell your son Michael that you couldn't, or that your son heard things in a different way, from your husband? Or mm-hmm. did it not make the difference that, people say it's supposed to?
Well, sure, it made a difference. I mean, one incident that I talk about in the book was one day my son came from school, and he walked upstairs and he knocked on the bedroom door where my husband was, and they stayed in there for like 45 minutes just talking. So he didn't say anything to me about what had gone on. And finally, just before he was going to bed, I said, well, hey, what's happening? What were you and Joe talking about? And he said, well, I had a problem at school. I had a problem with another guy at school. And I wanted to talk to Joe about it because I knew he would be able to tell me what to do. I was worried that you would just worry. And he was probably right. And I think that the reality is that a good, strong, healthy male. And I say that specifically because I'm not a person who believes that you just take any man and put him in the house and think that he's going to be able to help you raise your son. A good, strong, healthy male can bring into the dialogue around parenting some real resources and information that often women do not have. So that I was very glad that my husband was there.
And of course, too, your husband is a teacher, so he works with adolescent males, and he really understands the whole culture today of adolescent males.
Exactly.
So he could be of particular help.
Exactly.
In that area.
And I think also women, there's no doubt, and I don't have any problem saying this, even though I'm a feminist and I'm all for the particular abilities that women bring to parenthood, but mothers mother, okay? And we look upon our sons with eyes that may be somewhat biased, that may not always be as demanding as men look upon sons. And men know what the world is going to require of men. Men know what the world is going to put on men. And I think in that sense, you really do need to bring men into the whole parenting conversation. They know that in a way that women simply cannot.
Marita Golden is my guest. She's the author of the new memoir, Saving Our Sons. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Marita Golden. She's the author of Saving Our Sons, Raising Black Children in a Turbulent World. You work so hard to get your son a good education, to keep him out of trouble, to expose him to as much as you could culturally, educationally, and yet he still got into some amount of trouble. What's the worst thing that happened to him so far?
The worst thing that happened to him so far has been a shoplifting incident. In fact, it occurred one night when I was sitting in my study, actually working on this book. And he was supposed to have been home, and I was a little concerned because he was about a half an hour late. And there was a knock on the door, and so I opened the door, and there was my son standing before me, and a policeman, two policemen were on either side of him. And it turned out that he had been in the neighborhood drugstore, and he had stolen a pack of baseball cards. He had the money to buy them, but I think he wanted to see if he could get away with it, if he could outsmart the store manager. And in his case, he was very lucky because what happened was simply the store owner told him that he could never come in that store again. If he did come in that store again, that he would press charges against him. A similar incident happened with the nephew of my husband. And because he lived in a very different neighborhood, a neighborhood where there was a lot more crime, he ended up with a police record behind a similar incident. And of course, I was very upset. I was very concerned. He was put on punishment. And when I talked to some of my friends about it, they said, "Oh God, is that all he did? You don't want me to tell you what my son's done." So that's the worst thing. And I think that coming that close to really being in trouble with the law put a good scare into him. And we haven't had any trouble of that kind since.
So how do you think he was changed by actually getting taken to your home by a cop?
I think it taught him something about consequences. Mm-hmm. It taught him that when you break the law, even if it is just a pack of baseball cards, that you can pay. And I'm glad he learned the lesson. I'm glad that he learned it in a way that managed to teach him the lesson, but not embitter him. And my son was in that sense treated the way that white boys are treated pretty much pro forma. He was treated like a white kid in a suburban neighborhood. You go home, tell the parents, keep him out of the store, and he gets a slap on the wrist. And if the kid's smart, he doesn't do it again. Too often in the African-American community, what happened to my husband's nephew is what happens to black boys.
You must have thought when he got caught shoplifting, why would he do that? It's a middle-class family. He had money in his pocket. I mean, he could have easily afforded to buy this. So what went through your mind?
Well, I figured that he was doing it because he was adolescent. He was doing it because he was 14. He was doing it because he was His hormones were filtering into his brain, and he was semi-sane, which is what adolescence is about. He did it because he was testing limits. He did it because he was testing concepts of morality. He did it because he wanted to see if he could get something for nothing. So that even though I knew all those reasons intellectually, there was still the fear that will this be the last incident, or is this the beginning of a career in crime?
Do you think it's a lot harder to be an African-American mother now than it is to be a white mother?
Oh, of course. It's always been. It's always been. But I think that the challenges for all parents in this society are very, very intense and very, very real. When you hear the stories of affluent white teenagers in suburban communities who are abusing drugs and abusing alcohol, kids so bored and so isolated and alienated that they're sniffing butane lighters in order to find meaning in life. If I was a parent of that kid, I'd be very concerned, and I'd feel that my job as a parent was a real challenging one. So I think it's very difficult for all parents today, but it still is undeniably much more difficult because my son is perceived as a threat. My white sister's son is perceived as an asset. My son can walk into the room in a business suit. Her white son can walk in jeans and a sweatshirt, and it will be assumed that her son knows more than my son. It will be assumed that her son is a better person than my son. And these are realities that my son has to face and her son doesn't.
Your son is about to turn 17. He goes to a private boarding school, which you and he have been very happy with. He seems to really be thriving. Are you still worried about him, or do you feel like the worry years are behind you?
Well, he's going to start driving soon, and so I'll have something new to start worrying about. Is he going to have an accident? Well, you never stop worrying, but you do reach a point, I think, as your child matures and grows up, where you realize that you've done as much as you can do. You've done all that you can do, but there's a level on which also you never stop worrying.
Marita Golden, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Marita Golden is the author of the new memoir, Saving Our Sons, Raising Black Children in a Turbulent World. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.